With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Miko Itawi and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa huwa القيوم لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات وما من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات والأرض من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه يعلم ما بين أيديه ولا يحيطون بشيء من علمه إلا بما شاء وسع صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires Him not, and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Tehran warns that holding a special session of the UN Human Rights Council on Iran will negatively affect the country's cooperation with the West. The control of the U.S. Congress hangs in balance as hundreds of thousands of ballots are still being counted 3 days after Americans went to the polls. Plus, leaders of Southeast Asian nations begin their annual summit amid escalating violence and political gridlock in Myanmar. Hello and welcome. Your world news come to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. It's good to have you with us. Our top story this hour, Iran's foreign minister has slammed double standards of some Western governments rejecting their attempts to organize a special session of the UN Human Rights Council on Iran. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the comment in a phone call with UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. He said that the Geneva-based council session must be held on the governments promoting violence and terror and not on Iran that is a true defender of human rights. The top diplomat also warned about negative effects of a political move by the UN rights body on Iran's relations with the West. Guterres, for his part, rejected the Council's meddling in internal affairs of other countries. The Iranian foreign ministry summons the ambassador of the Azerbaijan Republic to Tehran over, quote, anti-Iran propaganda by Azeri officials and media. The ministry conveyed its strong protest against unfriendly remarks by officials in Baku, urging an immediate end to such actions. It also called on Baku to take appropriate measures to avoid their repetition. That follows the remarks by Azeri President Ilham Aliyev regarding Iran's recent maneuvers in the country's northwest. Earlier, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman also reacted to the comments by reiterating Tehran's support for the territorial integrity of all of its neighbors. Nasser Kanani added that Iran supports peaceful settlement of differences between Baku and Yerevan. He said a recent military exercise by Iranian armed forces was a regular move, and Iran's neighbors had been informed in advance. Vote counting is underway across the U.S. after Tuesday's midterm elections as control of the Congress remains undecided. The fate of the Senate has now come down to election results in three states. Either party can win a majority in the chamber by winning races in Arizona and Nevada. If that's a toss-up, contestants must wait until December 6th for a runoff race in Georgia to determine control of the Senate. In the U.S. House of Representatives, Republicans are leading and might be able to secure a slim majority in the chamber. For that, they need to win at least 218 seats. Democrats were able to perform better than expected in the recent elections. Some Republicans have blamed Donald Trump for their losses, as most of the candidates he supported ended up losing against Democrats.
Another nationwide election in the United States, and it will be another drawn-out, bitterly fought, and highly divisive process to determine the final outcome for Congress. Starting with the certainties, the last-minute predictions of a Republican red wave did not materialize. They did, however, take control of at least the House of Representatives, but likely with a much smaller majority than many expected. That means America will have a divided federal government, that President Joe Biden's policymaking will be hobbled for his final 2 years, and that the Democratic Party did suffer a significant national-level defeat.
Hasn't anyone had an education? I'm appalled. We had to take the constitutional test. It is so mean-spirited. Our kids are suffering. I have a 24-year-old. They do not like this country. They do not like what's going on, and their lives are hard. This is the American dream. Now they want to take away Medicare.
In a repeat of 2020, the Senate will likely come down to a runoff vote in the state of Georgia to be held on December 6th. That means Americans will have to endure nearly a month of uncertainty.
It's stupid that we would have that, need to take that much time, but part of it's because of a structure of how our, you know, we used to have this done really, you know, just 10 years ago, 15 years ago. We had it done in 2 days, at worst case scenario, you know. But in the last three national elections, it's suddenly become an issue of, you know, we've got all this, you know, false voting, fake voting, blah, blah, blah.
Near universal worries about politically related violence didn't happen on election day, but it increasingly seems to be more accurate to call it election month. Adding to the growing tension is that controversial ex-president Donald Trump is expected to announce on November 15th that he's running for the presidency again. America may soon be arguing over the 2024 election before the 2022 election has been completely decided. To the chagrin of Democrats and many Republicans, at least 74% of over 250 Trump-backed candidates were victorious, and so-called 2020 election deniers won repeatedly at top state and federal levels. It appears that the factional split within the Republican Party is more cemented than ever, but the unexpected closeness of the congressional vote reveals that the overall split between America's left and right is more narrow, contested, and sharper than ever. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
The U.S. has announced more military aid worth $400 million for Ukraine, despite warnings from Russia.
This authorization is the Biden administration's 25th drawdown of equipment from DoD inventories for Ukraine since August 2021. Capabilities in this package include missiles for Hawk air defense systems, 4 Avenger air defense systems and Stinger missiles, additional ammunition for the HIMARS, which are the high mobility artillery rocket systems.
The Pentagon official said the new military package includes short-range air defense systems and missiles. She said Spain has also made a commitment to provide U.S.-made Hawk air defense systems to Ukraine. Spain's defense ministry says the decision to send 2 more launchers, as well as artillery and mortar rounds, was in response to a request by NATO and Ukraine. The U.S. has been the biggest sponsor of the Ukrainian military since the beginning of its war with Russia in February. The value of the U.S. military aid now stands at over $18.6 billion. Moscow has repeatedly warned against the delivery of foreign arms to Ukraine, saying it only prolongs the conflict. The UK's cost of living crisis, due in large part by energy price hikes, is pushing more and more people to poverty. Said Purita travels to a deprived area in East London to find out how soaring prices are impacting vulnerable people and businesses. Have a look.
Walthamstow, a town in East London, home to more than 150,000 people, and the longest outdoor market in Europe.
It also happens to be one of the poorest areas, where a national cost of living crisis is pushing more and more people to the brink. And less money in people's pockets has meant less business for the shops and stalls here.
Couple that with soaring utility bills and increased prices that make running a successful business a real challenge.
My weekly sale is like half and half now, this time especially. For example, I'm earning about a weekly 1,000, for example, it's go 5. It's half and half now. And the people are scary, they don't spend much. They are very choosy now.
Quiet, very quiet. We see the market empty. Because we have people, but like pass, just on the pass. Nobody do shop because they don't have money. But rent now high. But energy right now very, very high. Gas high. And because that expensive right now.
The cost of living crisis has fed into the housing market as well, forcing Anne, who works in a coffee shop, to move house.
A couple months ago, I was living in a house share, but the landlord got really, like, worried about the cost of living, and he, like, tried so hard to, like, increase the prices little by little, and we ended up, like, having an argument about it, and he ended up, like, evicting me because, like, I didn't think it was fair, but he was forcing us to do stuff. So now, like, I'm paying, like, a really high price for, like, such a small room, no, like, living room or anything.
More than 6,000 people in this area claim universal credit. Recent surveys have found that nearly half of the children here live in poverty. Desperate parents and households are having to rely on charities such as this one to get by. We were told the Roxana Khan Foundation Food Bank gives donations to an increasing 300 households every week. Inflation remains stubbornly in the double digits, and the government has hinted at increased taxes and cuts to public spending. Many here and across the UK will find it even more difficult to make ends meet. Saeed Puriza, Walthamstow, East London.
Leaders from the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, have kicked off their annual summit in Cambodia. This year's meeting is focusing on Myanmar. The country has witnessed escalating violence and political gridlock since a military coup last year. Junta rulers are now facing criticism for their failure to implement a peace plan agreed last year. The plan includes ending hostilities and allowing access for special envoy and aid. ASEAN has said it's committed to the plan, but some members have been pushing for a stronger stance. Now, Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen, who opened the ASEAN summit, has called for vigilance and wisdom during times of economic and geopolitical turmoil. For more on that, I'm now joined by our correspondent in the South Korean capital, Seoul, Frank Smith. Frank, thank you so much for joining us. It's good to talk to you. So the ASEAN summit has begun, and Myanmar is going to be the main focus of the group. The question is, what challenges do you think are in the way of ending the political gridlock and violence in Myanmar? And would there be any option other than perhaps the agreed peace plan, options like expelling Myanmar from the group or sanctioning Myanmar? Would these be options on the table?
Well, I'm not sure they'd be options. One of the features of the ASEAN grouping is its kind of voluntary nature. It espouses non-interference in other states' affairs. Its agreements are voluntary, and it reaches the agreements that it does have through consensus. So, enforcing, for example, sanctions or some type of intervention in Myanmar is really out of the question for ASEAN. They are coming under more heat, especially from, for example, the United States, to pressure Myanmar more in terms of the human rights abuses that have been reported from there over the past particularly a few months following the coup d'etat that removed Aung San Suu Kyi from power last year and replaced her with a military dictatorship. So while those features of ASEAN, however, non-intervention, volunteer, nature of agreements and consensus represent a stumbling block. On the other side, when you do have, everybody together, it's a much sort of stronger, maybe stronger agreement. But again, coming to an agreement on, for example, as you mentioned, sanctioning Myanmar is something that most experts find really kind of unlikely at this point.
Right. Frank, also, when you look at the attendees to the summit, you will find the name of the Russian foreign minister. In your opinion, is his presence any significant?
Well, I think the attendance of Sergei Lavrov, as you mentioned, the Russian foreign minister here, you know, might offer an opportunity perhaps for interlocutors, especially from the United States. U.S. President Joe Biden is attending ASEAN, whereas previously former U.S. President Donald Trump skipped it. I think he attended once maybe in 2017 and then skipped it. So this is really a return of the U.S. to ASEAN sort of communications, if you want. And with the attendance of Lavrov, while it's, you know, probably pretty unlikely that Biden and Lavrov will get together, what is possible is for other members of the Biden administration that are attending to meet with Lavrov and maybe discuss Ukraine. And, you know, the U.S. is probably going to want to pressure Russia on this, and at least perhaps have some type of, you know, background dialogue take place there.
And finally, Frank, should we expect any major progress toward ending violence in Myanmar?
I'm not sure we can expect that, you know, out of this, but I think what it will do is it'll bring those other countries into the conversation a little bit, heighten the concern in the international community a little bit. You do have, you know, the ASEAN plus three, that's South Korea, China, and Japan following the ASEAN summit meeting. And then you have Biden there as well. So it is going to bring a lot of attention to the Myanmar issue that had really fallen off the radar, especially with Ukraine. So with that greater attention and scrutiny on the behavior of the coup dictatorship there comes hopefully pressure to refrain from the human rights abuses that have been reported.
Frank, thank you so much for coming on. That's Frank Smith, our correspondent in the South Korean capital, Seoul. Moving on, the nonstop years-long use of pellet weapons to quell anti-India protests in India-administered Kashmir is taking its toll on the victims, especially those who were hit in the eyes. Our correspondent Shahana Bhatt reports.
A recent study published in the Indian Journal of Ophthalmology reveals that a large number of those who sustained eye injuries due to the use of pellet guns in the mainstay of Srinagar between July and November 2016 have suffered some degree of vision loss. The survey conducted on 777 eye operations during the period reveals 80% of the victims have vision limited to counting fingers. 35-year-old Arshid Ahmed, a student of arts, was hit by pellets in both eyes in October 2016. 6 years on, Arshid says his vision of higher studies diminished just like his eyesight. Arshid's family was more fearful than hesitant to talk, and convincing Arshid to speak to Press TV about his condition was no less than a Herculean task. Before the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in 2019, New Delhi used shotguns for almost a decade to quell anti-India demonstrations in Indian-administered Kashmir, resulting in thousands of pellet injuries and the epidemic of vision loss in the region. Following the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019, people here might be upset about many things changing in the region. However, a remarkable achievement for government forces is that not even a single pellet gun has been used in the region following a tough crackdown on protesters. Kashmir has been a bone of contention between India and Pakistan for decades. Both lay claims to the region, but rule it in parts. India regards Kashmir as an integral part of its territory. Meanwhile, analysts say since the abrogation of Kashmir's special status, New Delhi seems to own everything in Kashmir except the problems of its people. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
In the limelight.
Western sanctions against Russia has backfired. Major oil and gas executives have warned that a real risk of a shortfall in EU lies ahead in 2023. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT wrote in this regard, the region is facing an unprecedented energy crunch following a drop in imports from Russia. The oil and gas shortages and record high inflation have resulted in an overall cost of living crisis across the EU. But while concerns are focused on the turmoil of the coming winter, it is the next cold season that they should really worry about. CEO of major oil trader Vitol, Russell Hardy, has said, "We've got a difficult winter ahead, and subsequent to that, we've got a more difficult winter in the year ahead of that because the production that is available to Europe in the first half of 2023 is considerably less than the production we had available to us in the first half of 2022, he said at a conference in Abu Dhabi last week. Energy prices have gone off the charts and are close to unaffordability, with many households spending 50% of their disposable income on energy or higher. BP CEO Bernard Looney has warned, agreeing with his colleague that the next winter in Europe could be even more challenging. Even though the EU has managed to fill its energy stockpiles by 90%, according to IEA data, the reserves are made up mostly of Russian gas. But as the bloc is speeding up the transition away from Russian pipeline deliveries, there will be no supplies from the bloc's former biggest supplier. The issue is not this winter, it will be the next one because we are not going to have Russian gas. 98% less next year, maybe nothing, Inichiev, Claudie Descalzi pointed out. Given the demand from China, a major importer of gas, and skyrocketing LNG prices, executives of energy companies are worried about possible social unrest, pointing out some EU countries like the Czech Republic, where households saw their energy bills increase tenfold. Russian gas supplies to the EU dropped by almost 50% since May, while exports to Japan and South Korea remained at about the same level as in 2021. The CEO of Novatek, Russia's second largest gas producer, revealed recently, Russian supplies to Europe decreased by nearly 50 billion cubic meters of gas in the past 4 or 5 months. As of October 1st, the slump has reached 47%. CEO Leonid Mikhelson said at the Eurasian Economic Forum in Baku, adding that the EU has almost replenished the shortfall by boosting LNG consumption by 65%. According to his estimates, the EU has received a total of 43 BCM in additional volumes of gas via its LNG terminals, with 29 BCM arriving from the US. Mikkelsen suggested that the upcoming winter will be the easiest of the next three, given that the bloc has managed to build up its gas stocks. However, he warned that with restored demand in China, the global economy may need about 60 to 70 million tons of LNG in the next 2 years to offset reduced pipeline gas supplies. Mikkelsen also pointed to the lack of new major projects until 2026. In his view, global GDP will struggle to grow amid the skyrocketing energy prices, and the only way to rein in the inflation and stabilize the markets is to beef up investment in new larger-scale energy projects. And this, according to Mikkelsen, is only possible with international cooperation. Tehran Times also wrote in this regard, before the Ukraine war, Russia contributed to the lion's share of Europe's energy imports. However, the conflict now, in its ninth month, disrupted that partnership and no more gas is flowing through Nord Stream 1. The energy crisis in Europe can be considered from two major aspects, the short-term effects and challenges and the long-term impacts and solutions. Although considering the condition of the Union's storage facilities, which, according to the International Energy Agency, IEA, are currently 95% full, Europe might be able to pass through this year's winter, but there is a heavy price that it must pay in doing so. Businesses across Europe are not just curbing their energy use and continuing on a business-as-usual basis. They are shutting down factories, downsizing, or relocating. Europe may well be on the way to deindustrialization. The Eurozone manufacturing activity has fallen to the lowest since May 2020. The October reading for S&P Global's PMI signaled a looming recession, falling on November and being the fourth monthly reading below 50, an indication of an economic contraction. In its latest analysis of the Europe's energy crisis published on November 3rd, the IEA said that the Union could face a shortage of as much as 30 billion cubic meters, BCM, of natural gas during the next year's peak summer period for refilling its gas storage sites. In the report dubbed Never Too Early to Prepare for Next Winter, Europe's gas balance for 2023 to 2024, IEA cautions that the caution provided by current storage levels, as well as recent lower gas prices and unusually mild temperatures, should not lead to overly optimistic conclusions about the future. IEA Executive Director Fatih Birol said, "With the recent mild weather and lower gas prices, there is a danger of complacency creeping into the conversation around Europe's gas supplies, but we are by no means out of the woods yet." A look at the report shows that the European Union is going to face a great challenge in meeting its energy needs in the coming years, and considering the heavy cost of shipping gas from long distances, Iran could have been a significant contributor to the resolution of this issue.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Midstream.
Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani inaugurated the era of his new government with a promise to hold early legislative elections within a year, after amending the electoral law in what appeared to be an effort by him to appease to the Sadr movement, which holds on to the option of taking it back to the streets despite its silence. So far, that Sadrist option represents the main threat to a Sudanese government, a threat whose possibility is reinforced given the difficulty of the task of combating rampant corruption in the country, which did not witness progress during the reign of the outgoing Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi. In the meantime, the participating parties in the government, especially the coordinating framework and the forces representing the Sunni and Kurdish components, seemed more than satisfied with the launch of the new government. However, no one has illusions that the Sudani government will find solutions to all of Iraq's intractable internal problems, and above them, problems with regional dimensions, especially external interventions. And therefore, the participating forces shed light on one fundamental uplift for it, which is to get the country out of the state of political impasse that continued for a whole year. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Sudani is currently busy trying to solve the Kurdish-Kurdish dispute over the reconstruction and environment portfolios. The Kurdish Union Party demands the Ministry of Environment, while the Democratic Party demands both ministries. These are major differences between the two parties on a number of issues, some of which are related to the internal situation of the Kurdistan region. The legal period for submitting candidates to ministries is 1 month from the date of assigning cabinet. This is what the Iraqi constitution stipulates in Article 76. But there is also a decision by the federal court, which states that postponing votes on some ministries to another period not specified by the decision are still allowed, which the prime minister can later submit to parliament to acquire trust. For now, Prime Minister Sudani's government faces a number of service challenges that trouble the Iraqi street, including addressing the weakness of the electrical sector, repairing the shortage in hospitals and health centers, controlling markets and facing high prices, in addition to addressing the problem of water scarcity, reducing unemployment by creating job opportunities, and encouraging internal and external investments. As for the role of the U.S. in all of the above, considering the delicate stage in which the Iraqi political process is going through, it does not seem that the U.S. administration is far from what is happening. It is following the situation very closely while directing its tools in a way that serves the American strategic goals in Iraq. It remains to be seen if Sudanese government will survive through these so-called U.S. strategies or not. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The new government in Iraq, headed by Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani, obtained the confidence of parliament by an absolute majority after about 2 weeks of assigning a Sudani the task of forming it, and more than a year during which the country experienced a severe political crisis. With the convening of its first regular session last week, the test of the new government's ability to carry out the main task it has taken upon itself began, especially the struggle against corruption, which requires the will of the participating forces to grant freedom of movement to its prime minister. However, the Iraqi government is missing two ministers dedicated to the Kurds due to a dispute over the division between the Kurdistan Democratic Party and the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, which reflects the first stumbling block for the new prime minister. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hussein Ibrahim, expert in Iraqi and Persian Gulf political affairs at the Al Akhbar Daily newspaper. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Hussein. Now, Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani pledged to fight corruption that has devastated Iraq and to work to repair ties with the government of the semi-autonomous government or the semi-autonomous regional Kurdistan of Iraq and build an economy that will create jobs and improve public services. This is what he pledged during his statement. Well, him and all the past Iraqi members of parliament have, prime ministers have pledged the same. Is there any difference in what Mr. Shia al-Sudani has said to his predecessors?
Yes, I do believe that there is a difference in the Iraqi scene in comparison to what it was during the reign of Mustafa Qadhimi and during past governments. I think that corruption in Iraq has spread to unprecedented levels, which makes it imperative for Mr. Sudani to work to eliminate corruption. I think he is trying to do so at the moment by firing a lot of public employees who were illegally employed during the government of former PM Qadimi, which happened when this government was a caretaker one. However, the main question remains, will fighting corruption in Iraq touch high-level positions, or will it only be confined to fighting corruption at the basic level? I think that the rooted corruption in Iraq, which has been ongoing for decades now, needs a lot of time to be eliminated, only if there is an actual will to fight it to begin with. Corruption inside Iraq has different faces, yet I believe that the basis of corruption in Iraq goes back to the relationship between high-level Iraqi officials with the U.S. occupation, through which the dirty money flows towards and away from Iraq. This is why even the government of Mr. Sudani includes officials who are actually part of former cabinets and were very much involved in high-level corruption. So the question is, will Sudani be able to fight that level of corruption? I think this question needs some time to be truly answered in Iraq. I think Sudani will start working at the basic level and not the high level.
Well, although we didn't hear Said Muqtada Sadr's opinion about the government, he's not part of the government, he has withdrawn all his members of parliament from the Iraqi parliament, he remains a potent political force with the power to mobilize supporters in the streets, as we saw had happened before in Baghdad and elsewhere in other provinces of Iraq, to create instability for any government that would take the charge in Baghdad, which he is not approving of. He has been clear that he expects early elections. Will Prime Minister Sudani deliver these maybe demands, since it seems that he is eager to get the approval of the Sadr movement, and it's not really clear why?
The Iraqi government already vowed in its initial statement that it will be headed towards an early election within 1 year, while also promised to formulate a new electoral law within 3 months from now. However, the silence of Sayyid Muqtada Sadr has nothing to do with these promises made by PM Sudani. These promises were already in place even before the Sadrist movement took to the streets in the past months. So if it were enough, he wouldn't have asked his followers to hit the streets, which nearly led Iraq to a Shia-Shia civil war. I think that the current international conditions is the main reason behind the formulation of a new government in Iraq, led by PM Sudani, simply because the world cannot bear another war in Iraq, not even a civil internal one, because it will result in a regional explosion and will also result in a severe increase in oil prices worldwide. Iraq exports 4 million barrels of oil per day. If you add that to the current sanctions against Russian oil, then the global oil market will be hit by severe blow, leading to an insane increase in oil prices, pushing global inflation even further. Hence, I believe that it was the current international conditions that led to the formation of the current Iraqi government. As we know, the political factions which have made up the current Iraqi cabinet have different international loyalties. Hence, these international countries that have direct impact on Iraq, one of which is the USA, demanded from its loyalists to accept the formation of this new government and give it trust and approval. Hence, Sayyid Muqtada Sadr cannot stand in the face of this government on his own, no matter his party's power. In the end, he only got 73 MPs in the Iraqi parliament, which is less than a quarter of the Iraqi parliament. Hence, on his own, he has no majority or power to attain political gains or block the work of the current government on his own without being allied with other political blocs.
But let's say there was some sort of an electoral change, amendment to the electoral law at the parliament, and Sayyid Muqtada Sadr doesn't like that kind of amendment. He didn't like the new law. What are the coordination coalition?
Currently, there is no ground for a civil war or internal warring inside Iraq. If the conditions were readily available with parties who were strong enough to initiate a fight, then any clash would have taken the country to a civil war. However, last August, Iraq witnessed risky clashes that resulted in 50 deaths in the Green Zone. After which the Iraqi political blocs, including the Sadrist movement, took a step back away from internal warring. If a civil war was to take place in Iraq, then August would have been the perfect month to do so. But these specific incidents during the August clashes shows that conditions are not ripe in the region and international arena for a civil war in Iraq. A civil war, as we know, especially in a country like Iraq, a country that undergoes many foreign interventions and has vast borders with many Arab countries like the Persian Gulf Arab states. Knowing that the Persian Gulf Arab states actually pushed for a civil war in Iraq, but failed because simply the world is currently not ready for an Iraqi civil war. Even Sayyid Muqtada Sadr himself does not want to see Iraq falling into a civil war. However, he did possess many pressuring tools that were stripped from him in the recent political wave in Iraq.
It remains
to be seen how the Iraqi political scene will be played by the opposing parties after the formation of this new government led by Mr. Shaya Sudani. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Hussein Ibrahim, expert in Iraqi and Persian Gulf political affairs at the Al-Akhbar daily newspaper, for joining us. Thank you very much for your contribution. Now, please stay tuned, because next we are going to talk about the presidential and governmental void in Lebanon.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Lebanese President Michel Aoun concluded his six-year presidential term last week, leaving no successor to replace him. This followed his announcement that he had accepted the resignation of the current caretaker government led by Prime Minister Najib Miqati, who failed to form a government after the elections in May of this year. Amid the constitutional chaos in Lebanon that the country is actually living through today, there are those who claim that Miqati's caretaker government will be unable to manage the affairs of the country. However, what the country needs now is to put the constitutional process on the right track, avoid political outbursts and slander, and elect a president of the republic, and then form a real government with full powers to organize public institutions in Lebanon. Lebanon back to political void in this following report.
Lebanon sank further into acute economic crisis as President Michel Aoun's term of office ended on October 31st. Parliament members began the process of electing his successor on September 29. The political tug-of-war over this post, reserved for a member of the Maronite Christian community, is expected to be lengthy. During the last presidential election, Lebanon went without a president for 29 months. The Lebanese parliament's 128 members of parliament have the constitutional power to elect the head of state. Voting is usually conducted by a secret ballot, and the president of the republic is elected by a two-thirds majority in the first round and by an absolute majority in subsequent rounds. Unsurprisingly, the parliamentary sessions so far were not a success. No consensus has yet been found on who should be Aoun's successor due to the divisions within the political class. Parliament is so polarized that it can't even agree on the need to form a new government to replace the one currently led by incumbent Prime Minister Najib Miqati, who has been in charge of current affairs since May, when the new parliament's mandate began. The country's constitution states that if an election is not held within the last 10 days of the incumbent's mandate, parliament can no longer legislate because it must only hold presidential sessions. The Lebanese, who are already facing the worst economic crisis in the country's history, already know that the presidential process can last a long time. Due to the lack of consensus between the different political camps and various political blockages, they endured 29 months of institutional vacuum after former President Michel Sleiman's term in office ended on May 25, 2014. The main question in Lebanon today is which Maronite is going to be the president? And most relevant for gaining the support of parliamentarians, what political affiliation will the new president have? This kind of political deadlock is not a rare situation for Lebanon. The country is used to having vacuums in power. However, this time people care more about their daily living rather than about which Maronite will be named president. This vacuum finds Lebanon amid economic, financial, and political crises. And with the winter coming and the current energy crisis, the situation will most likely worsen. The stresses of the day-to-day living take people's minds off politics. The living standards are going down, and little do the Lebanese care if there's a government or not, as long as they can have their daily life dealt with, especially that bread, gas, and the basic commodities are now considered a luxury. Even if the caretaker government tries its best to fill the current political vacuum, it is still unauthorized to take the major important decisions that the Lebanese people desperately need now to overcome the current crisis.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Jamal Wakim, author and academic and political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us. Dr. Wakim, now, unsurprisingly, the parliamentary sessions to elect a president were so far not successful in Lebanon. No consensus has yet been found on who should be Aoun's successor due to the divisions within the different political classes in Lebanon. How much time do you think it will take to agree on a new president for the Lebanese public? And who are the most prominent candidates in your opinion?
Well, I believe that we might live under a vacuum for several months, if not years, especially with the insistence of some candidates on running, despite the fact that they do not have the possibility to have the majority or to have quorum. The problem lies in the fact that two contenders to the presidency are allies to Hezbollah, i.e. Sulaiman Franjiyi on one hand and Jibran Bessil on the other hand. And too bad no one of these candidates is willing to step down for the other because both insist on being presidents. It is noteworthy that 6 years ago, when Aoun was running for president, Sulaiman Franjiyi, the deal was that Sulaiman Franjiyi would step down on condition that he will be the next president after the end of Michel Aoun's term. But now that Michel Aoun ended his term, Jibran Bessil, the son-in-law of Michel Aoun and head of the Free Patriotic Movement, insisted on being himself a candidate, noting that he is unlikely to have a quorum in the parliament because more than one-third are for the opposition or for the bloc that opposes Jibran Bessil candidacy. I mean here the Falange Party, the Lebanese Forces, and the Change members of parliament. Whereas with regards to, added to this, Jibran Bessil has the hostility of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia
And the Amal movement in Lebanon.
And the Amal movement, which
basically
both will not vote for him. Yeah, which both will not vote for him. Or let's say in the case of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, it could influence some blocs in the opposition to vote for Sulaiman Franjiyi, mm-hmm. as Sulaiman Franjiyi has contacts with Saudi Arabia, unlike the case of Jibran Bessil. Mm-hmm. So this is the real crisis so far. And added to this crisis, I believe that the regional and international atmosphere is unlikely to lead to a compromise in Lebanon as there is a standoff between the United States on one hand and Iran on the other hand.
Well, amid this political deadlock, the Saudi embassy in Lebanon commemorated the 33rd anniversary of the signing of the Taif Agreement. I really didn't know that we celebrated that, but anyways, they commemorated it with the participation of the caretaker Prime Minister Najib Miqati and current and former Lebanese officials, while significant parliamentarian blocs were absent from that meeting. What is Saudi Arabia trying to say after it had abandoned Lebanon and maybe the or Lebanese politics in general, especially after they kidnapped the then Prime Minister Saad Hariri in 2017?
Well, I believe that this whole scene that we saw on Saturday was an absurd scene because for too many reasons. First, the Taif Agreement was in reality an agreement between Saudi Arabia, Syria, and the United States of America. Now that Syria is out of the agreement, so the agreement itself
is void.
Yes. In addition, the agreement had a key player at the time, which was Hariri senior, Rafiq Hariri. And Saudi Arabia has chosen to eliminate his son, Saad Hariri, alongside the whole legacy of the Hariri family. So this is another step that makes the agreement void. It's noteworthy that the majority of the Lebanese, let's say, factions, or the representatives of the Lebanese factions, the majority of them were present in the ceremony except for the Shia. And this leads us to conclude that it was a gathering against the Shia sect in Lebanon, which would lead to conflict in the country. I believe that the move by the Ambassador Bukhari was to hide the too many failures that he faced in Lebanon in the past few years, despite his continuous attempts to achieve or make an achievement against Hezbollah, against the bloc that is anti-US, anti-Saudi Arabia in Lebanon. And this is why we had this, let's say, ceremony.
But ever since the Taif agreement was reached, the 128 parliament seats have been divided equally between Muslims and Christians. And within these two dominational blocs, the number of parliament members is determined based on their community's demographic weight. For example, the Shi'at have 27, the Maronites have 34 members in parliament. This was decided during the last census, which was carried out in 1932. Yeah. In Lebanon. Does Lebanon need a new Taif agreement, this time possibly a strictly internal one, or rather a whole new constitution?
Well, too bad. The Lebanese system, the confessional system, has led the country to be, let's say, a reflection of regional and international influence. And in order to end this and to have a full local deal, without foreign intervention, I believe that we need to end this confessional formula and head towards a civil state in Lebanon, which is unlikely in the near future, too bad, because we don't have alternative forces that could lead the country towards a civil society. And in case we have a civil society, so the representatives in the parliament will no longer be considered or appointed because of them being Shia, Sunni, or Christians, but because they really represent the whole country with disregard to the confessional division in the country. Mm-hmm. So, but too bad, this is a sort of utopia for the time being. It's a dream that will never be achieved anytime soon.
So what we get from your answers here, Dr. Jamal, is Lebanon is going into a deep state of political void, possibly for the upcoming year or more.
Well, too bad, yeah.
I want to thank you very much, Dr. Jamal Wakim, author and academic and political commentator, for joining us. Thank you very much for your contribution. Thank you. See you next week.
There is no end in sight regarding the cost of living crisis in Europe. This continent was doomed to decline after the 2008 global financial recession. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, Germany's gas storage facilities may rapidly become depleted if the weather turns cold, Klaus Müller, the head of Germany's Federal Network Agency, said in an interview with Der Spiegel, published recently. Müller told the outlet, "A few freezing cold days are enough for a dramatic increase in gas consumption. We know from historical data that when it gets really frosty, the storage tanks are quickly drained." The official added that Germany can get through the winter, but only if both citizens and industries join efforts to end lower gas consumption by at least 20%. Last month, the country's industries were able to lower consumption by 20%, and private households and businesses did even better with 42%, he said, noting, however, that this had to do with the warm weather and might change in the event of a cold snap. As of November 2nd, Germany's gas storage facilities were 99.3% full, which, according to Müller, is enough to keep the country going for up to 10 weeks as the only source of gas. Germany, along with other EU states, has been gradually reducing its reliance on Russian energy supplies. According to Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock, the share of Russian gas among the country's energy imports recently dropped to 6-8%, while in 2021, more than half of Germany's gas supply came from Russia. To make up for the loss, Berlin has focused on building liquefied natural gas terminals. The country will have two floating regasification for receiving seaborne LNG by the end of the